welcome to Australia Talks Books on Radio National. I'm Sandy McCutcheon, and joining me in a couple of minutes will be a very warm welcome back to Ramona Cavale. But first, let me introduce the book. Our first book for 2004 has recently been voted Australia's most popular novel. It is, of course, Tim Winton's Cloud Street, the story of two families and a house. Families are exiles from the country in a city house that is as alive as any of the characters that inhabit it, and it threatens never to become the promised land, and yet tantalizingly hope is in the air and in the characters. As Oriel says to Lester at one point, we make good, Lester. We make war on the bad and don't surrender. Cloud Street flows with life, rich and raw, unadorned by writerly tricks or heightened language. It also transports us into the realm of the magical, the mysterious black man, quick lamb glowing in the dark, illuminated, and fish flowing through the novel like dark water with surprising insights. Now, rereading Cloud Street is even more enjoyable than the first time round. It was, I've got to say, like dropping in on old friends and knowing that you're welcome. I loved it. And speaking of welcomes and people we love, Ramona Cavale, welcome back.
Thank you, Sandy. It's lovely to be back with you. And you're right, it's a great warm-hearted book full of luck and fate and fish and gambling and Anzacs. And if you'd like to have your say in the program, you can join our online discussion at abc.net.au/rn and follow the links to Australia Talks Books, or phone us. I'd like you to phone us. I want to talk to you. It's been a while. On 1-800-802-341, 1-800-802-341. And also joining us for the second time on Australia Talks Books, Tim Winton from Perth. Tim, welcome.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Yeah, nice to have you back again.
Wherever I am.
Yes, disembodied voice out there in the universe. Nice to have you back with us, Tim.
Oh, thanks, Sandy.
Well, let's start with a reading. I'm going to be the one who reads this bit, and it's going to be such a pleasure, because just have a listen to how this beautiful big book starts. Will you look at us by the river, the whole restless mob of us on spread blankets in the dreamy, briny sunshine, skylarking and shyacking about for one day, one clear, clean, sweet day in a good world in the midst of our living. Yachts run before an unfelt gust with bag-necked pelicans riding above them, the city their twitching backdrop, all blocks and points of mirror light down to the water's edge. 20 years, they all say, sprawling and drinking. There's ginger beer, stagger juice and hot flasks of tea. There's pasties, a ham, chicken legs and a basket of oranges, potato salad and dried figs. There are things spilling from jars and bags. The speech is silenced by a melodious belch which gets big applause. Someone blurts on a baby's belly and a song strikes up. Unless you knew, you'd think they were a whole group, an earthly vision. Because look, even the missing are there, the gone and taken are with them in the shade pools of the peppermints by the beautiful, the river. And even now, one of the here is leaving. He hears nothing but the water, and the sound of it has been in his ears all his life. Shirt buttons askew, his new black shoes filling with sand, he strides along the beach near the river's edge, nearly hyperventilating with excitement. His tongue can't lie still. It rounds his mouth, kicks inside like a mullet. He tramps through the footprints of the city's early morning rambles and nightly assignations towards the jetty he's been watching the past half hour. He breaks into a run. His shirt tail works its way out. It's low tide, so he reaches the steps to the jetty without even wetting his shoes, though he would have waded there if need be, waded without a qualm, because he's hungry for the water. He wants it more than ever. What a knockout beginning.
Isn't
that is.
Amazing.
And Tim, I reread your book this week, but before I did, I tried to remember what I could about reading Cloud Street the first time. And what I recalled was the house that breathed in and out as if it were alive, and about the warmth of the families who shared it, and about the celebration of a very Australian way of life. And I bet I'm not alone in that. And I wondered, is that what you thought you were going to do as you, you know, got into Cloud Street, got into the house, began to write it?
Well, first, thank you, but no, I didn't know what I was doing. I was honestly just finding my way day to day over the years that I was working on it, and I suppose in retrospect, enjoying myself enough not to worry. I didn't have a plan.
Tim, what's it like revisiting a novel that you wrote over a decade ago?
Well, it's a little bizarre. I mean, I haven't reread it. unlike you two, I haven't done my homework. So I'm sure I'm going to be caught out in any
question. There will be a test, you know.
I won't pass the verb, the oral. I just know it. But it's very odd. It's really, I guess the only equivalent would be, you know, an old photo album of, you know, how you looked at school and your daggy haircut and the girlfriend who, you know, only spoke to you for 9 minutes of your entire life. You know, it's such a long time ago. I mean, I wrote this book in the 1980s, and I had a toddler who's now 20 years old. So it's you know, and he has brothers and sisters. So it's a, you know, it's a very long time ago, and it's almost as though it was written by somebody else. But I have to say, you know, hearing Ramona read it, there was a flicker of recognition.
It's got your name on the cover, though. That must be yours. Tim, tell me about the creation of the house at Cloud Street. It's a kind of house that we're instantly comfortable in. It's big and rambling, and all kinds of possibilities are there. I think you said it's a big sagging joint. Is it totally a house of your imagination? Was there ever a house like that for you?
No, there was never a place. And, you know, the more I say it, the less effect that seems to have. There are people, you know, who seem to troll about trying to locate the exact house, and I've had lots of mail to that effect over the years. Someone actually gave up and just named a block of flats Cloud Street in the neighbourhood just to stump everybody, I think. I mean, once I realised I had these two families on the go, and I just thought about how, you know, it would be interesting to put them together, and I needed a house, so I had to make up a house, and that's all it was. I mean, the neighbourhoods are, you know, the neighbourhoods that my grandparents and my parents grew up in between the wars and after the war, and that was all I was going on, really, a kind of a milieu and some family mythology.
Yes. It made me start thinking about all of the great houses that have touched me in literature, and a couple in particular, I think, Georges Perec's Life, a User's Manual, and my favourite, the wonderful, bizarre architecture of the house in Crowley's book, Little Big. Are there others that come to your mind, Ramona, when you think about houses and books?
Of course, Jane Eyre, you know, sort of gothic, scary house with the first wife in the top. What's it called? The top? The attic. And My Mother's House, a book by Colette that I really loved when I was a kid. I mean, it certainly, Tim, gives you a big theatre to work in, doesn't it? It's sort of like having a lot of different stage sets.
Yeah, and I needed a big one because there was a few of them. And then later in the process, I realised there was more to come in terms of, you know, strangers and blow-throughs and whatever.
You had to have a shop at the front too.
Yeah, well, I had to have a shop at the front partly because that so much family mythology revolved around my father's parents' suburban shop. And
what did it sell?
Oh, they just had everything really. But it was mostly a sort of small goods kind of neighbourhood shop.
Homemade ice cream.
Yes, yeah. My grandfather was a pretty accomplished pastry cook, and he did a mean ice cream, and they were a kind of a very sort of notable couple in the neighbourhood between the First World War and Vietnam, I suppose. So, and interesting talking about houses. I mean, when I was writing this book, I began it in Australia, and then I left for the first time and lived in Paris and in Ireland and in Greece. And particularly when I was in Ireland, I really did literally understand that houses had their own personalities and their own lives, and yeah, they just had to be standing long enough to
soak
take
it
on.
Up.
Yeah, and you know, in the culture that I came from, in suburban Australia, you know, anything older than 30 years, particularly in Perth, you know, you get the bulldozer, you know. So, and I was also writing it at a time when Perth was being knocked over in the sort of glut and orgy of the 80s.
You mentioned Ireland, and that, of course, that makes me think about language and makes me think about, you know, wonderful kinds of language, and you actually invent some really lovely Australian words, at least I think you do invent them, otherwise I've led a very sheltered life in Melbourne all these years, like water blur for tears, and water lap and prawn kick describe it of a river. Are they fishing terms, or did you make?
No, they were just making it up. I mean, I was homesick, and I was in Irish winter, and I was in a tiny little cottage out in the middle of the bogs. I was just making it up. I had an old dictionary of
Australian vernacular, but it just felt like there wasn't enough in it to satisfy my great longing, so I just made words up.
Oh, they're great words, and it's almost like the Germans do, you know, where they combine different things and stick them all together.
Compound
words, which are really very efficient, as you'd expect.
But they do irritate the reviewers of the TLS, though. You get a sort of brogue-wearing, tweedy sort of chap, from Merton College or whatever, who just, just cannot cope with the fact that you've made words up. It's all, it's morally wrong.
Yes.
Well, they probably had trouble with Joyce, didn't they, as well?
Yeah, that's probably a different story.
We're talking with Tim Winton. The book is Cloud Street. This is Australia Talks back on Radio National. In just a moment, we'll come to your calls. And by the way, there is still one spare line if you're very fast, 1-800-802-341. Talking about the Australianness, just before we go to the calls, Tim, I think it was Joseph Olshan in the New York Times book review who, though loving Cloud Street, observed that the structure of the novel was, and I'm quoting, not easy for an American reader. Points of view switched by paragraph and some parts seem deliberately inscrutable. How did the Australianness of Cloud Street travel in translation? Because the book's been translated widely.
Very surprisingly, it's probably the book that's been the widest travelled of my work. It must be a nightmare to translate. It's only now just being translated into French, quite late in the piece when all my other books have already been translated into French. People seem to take it on in the same way that, there I was, a boy in Perth in the 70s reading Faulkner. I mean, talk about impenetrable and, deliberately opaque. I think if you can read Faulkner, or if you can read at least a bit of Joyce, then, there's hope for a book like Cloud Street.
Yes, let's go to some calls.
Can I just ask one little question?
Yeah, go on.
What about things like Khan and some of those Australian words?
They sound like other people's English, though. People kind of know what, if you say Khan out loud in the context of a sentence.
You'd have to kind of whine it, though, wouldn't you?
Yeah, well, I did a few whiny readings in my years touring the book.
Anyway, let's get some calls. Sandy.
Bangalow, New South Wales, first stop, and Catherine. Hello, Catherine.
Oh, hello. Tim, I'm actually a teacher of the novel, and I thoroughly enjoyed reading it, but it's incredibly complex when we actually try to explore different dimensions of it. From listening to you, you may not have had any of those intentions, and I'd like you to elaborate on that a little bit. But my question is with regard to the spiritual aspects of the text, which there's lots been written about it, and I'm wondering if it's only on reflection that you're aware of all of those aspects to it, or were they intentional? And do you think that you were talking about an aspect of spiritualism that existed in that era that is lacking today, or would you like to comment on that?
Oh, it's such a big one. I'm not sure that Australia was a more spiritual place in the era of the novel from the 40s to the 60s. I mean, I don't think Australia has ever been a particularly spiritual place under our current incarnation. I mean, obviously, I think the interesting thing about Australia is it's probably the most irreligious culture implanted upon perhaps the most spiritual continent on the globe, and it's interesting. And people like Patrick White, who trundled down that trail a long time before me, were writing about the strange anomalies between this brooding rich spiritual landscape and a culture that was essentially about shopping and conforming. I suspect we're probably exploring a little more now than we were then. As to what I was trying to say in the book, I'm really not sure. I think a lot of it was accidental. I mean, I'm not a completely unconscious writer, but the people in the books say the kinds of things that that the characters I'd imagined said, and I, you know, they were just saying the things that humans say. Some of those people are spiritual, and others are, you know, purely material, purely for the, you know, for the moment.
Catherine, thank you very much indeed for calling. That's Catherine from Bangalore, New South Wales.
And now Suzanne is with us too, from Balnarring in Victoria. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello, Ramona. It's interesting to hear a spiritual quality mentioned, because I've found it very... I found Cloud Street and Dirt Music and other books of Tim's very earthy, very Australian, and you've now, two of you, have mentioned a quality in his writing that I find, and that is, especially in the early part, it is James Joycean. I felt this is like Ulysses. It's flowing. It was just a continuous flow, and I found that really interesting. Were you aware of that, Tim?
No, to be honest. I mean, I was aware that it was flowing and I was enjoying that, but I've never actually read, I've never read Ulysses, and I've certainly never read Finnegan's Wake. I mean, I've had a look and thought, oh my God, this is, you know, too hard for me. And I love the short stories, but I, you know, after the short stories, Joyce sort of lost my interest. The sound of it and the music's good, but, it's probably like, you know, for me, like opera, you know, you're quite happy for it to go on as long as the doors are open somewhere. And you can, make a quick escape.
It's very Australian, your writing, can only be written by an Australian.
Yeah. Well, you know, perhaps so, but honestly, my influences were much more American than I suspect people realise. I mean, I really adored Faulkner, and I guess that's a, you know, it's an American Joyce, I suppose. Just that, you know, at least in Faulkner, at least 3 out of 5 pages, you know what's going on, roughly. You're sort of in the ballpark, at least.
Yes. Suzanne, thank you so much for calling with Suzanne.
Thank you.
And Tim, you've got a lot of water in the book, so maybe that accounts for the flowing quality. You know, you like to spend time on water.
I think I just, the setting could have done the job for me. But I think it was, you know, I was trying to write, as I had been trying to write for the, you know, the 10 years before that, when I was publishing all the other novels and stories, I was trying to write more and more and more the way I spoke and the people that I grew up with spoke and the people that I knew spoke. And I particularly remember, you know, when I was in school, those novels that we did get to read were tended to be, even the Australian novels, tended to feature a very, very British diction.
Yes.
Well, you knew damn well that the person who wrote this book, if you met them in the street, they would speak much more like you than like their book. And there's nothing wrong with, you know, changing your diction and projecting as a writer. But for me personally, in terms of where I came from and what I felt close to and inspired by, were writers whose language was, you know, even in a confected way, which you have to as a writer, you have to you know, manufacture something, but whose writing sounded like their speech and the speech of ordinary people, at least, you know, the kinds of people in the book.
Yes. We're talking about Cloud Street. We're talking with Tim Winton, Ramona Cavall, Sandy McCutcheon, and you. And the you in this case is Linda in Sydney. Hello, Linda.
Hi, Sandy, and hi, Ramona, and hi, Tim. Sandy, when you told us recently that Cloud Street had been voted the most popular Australian book, I knew I had to read it, and so I've only just finished it.
Oh, very first time.
Yes.
Oh, well done, yes.
And I found it a very special book, and in fact, I found many themes running through it, and I'd just like to comment on one of them and then ask Tim a question.
Right.
Well, I found the theme of the search for an authentic Australian spirituality through it. And many of the characters kept saying, I wish I had something to believe in. And I could see at least 3 different ways that this longing was expressed. Firstly, there's Sam Pickles, who believed in luck. And amusingly, his sense of security came in accepting bad luck as the norm for his life. And then secondly, throughout the book, there are traces of a decaying Christian religious faith. Lester Lamb says grace at meals, very quickly and uncomfortably, and his wife Oriel reads her Bible, though she wonders if it makes any difference to what happens to her. And there are the amusing descriptions of the church weddings where the bridal couple and families are very out of place. And there are many quotations from the Bible amusingly applied to non-religious activities. And now the third expression of this search for an authentic spirituality is more mystical and dreamlike, even pantheistic. And it's expressed in many ways. The unnatural glow on the face of Quick Lamb and his brother Fish, Quick's visions of water in the middle of a wheat field and thinking he's seeing his brother Fish riding across the field in a boat made from an oranges box. And most strikingly, and I won't give away too much of the story, but the voice from the sea that responds to Fish's 20-year longing and tells him he'll soon be a real man.
Yeah, but Linda, what's your question?
My question is, Tim,
I mean, you've just passed the PhD standard.
I wanted to explain, yep. Tim, where I was coming from, so you'll understand the question. So, Tim, in Cloud Street, were you saying that Australians are searching for an authentic spirituality, something to embrace that is greater than themselves, something to believe in?
I suppose I was. I mean, and thanks for your statement as much as your question. It saved me reading the book again. It was a real good refresher. I mean, it's terrific. I remember a whole lot of things in the book now. I don't think I was saying something. I think I was probably just admitting something, and it was a kind of the people in the book, in a sense, you know, thinking aloud. And it was at an interesting time. I think, you know, in my grandparents' generation and the beginning of my parents' generation, perhaps, you know, the sort of the imported version of Christianity had kind of had withered, and there was no real engagement with you know, with Aboriginal culture and spirituality. And the only thing that people could really believe in was the army. You know, the first AIF and the second AIF, and of course, you know, in recent years, that seems to have been a resurgent religious belief in Australian politics.
Exactly.
You know, from Kirribilli down. But
do you think we're still searching for authentic Australian spirituality?
Yeah, I think we're trying to find something that works for us, and I think that's probably not any, you know, pure tradition. I mean, I was, you know, influenced by my Christian upbringing, but I think the sort of imported kind of, yeah, the sort of anglicised version of Christianity that we had sort of only applies up to a very short point, you know, to your long white socks. So, yeah. Linda, thank you very much for that.
Tim, can I just bring in something else that, I mean, struck me talking about the spiritual thread through it? You make some very strong statements about self-determination and humanity, and the quote that I guess stuck with me from the very first reading and really grabbed me the second time through was, you can't steer if you're not going faster than the current. If you're not under your own steam, then you're just debris stuff floating. We're not frightened animals, Lester, just waiting with some dumb, thoughtless patience for the tide to turn. I mean, this is pretty strong stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's obviously it's coming from, you know, the matriarch of the family. Oriel is just a... I think I describe her somewhere in the book as like a little boxy sergeant major. I mean, yeah. she's the person who is the least passive, the least content person to just take what fate sends her way. And in a sense, she's almost trying to, you know, she's trying to throw herself higher by her own bootlaces, which, you know, is a difficult
task.
It's a task that has sort of has its limits, but I think it's just the passion with which she refuses to take things. It was interesting to me, and of course for me it was born out of, you know, having heard lots and lots of conversations as a bored child in the 60s under the dining table, particularly at my grandparents' place. And that was the other thing I was doing. In terms of language, just, you know, revisiting the sounds of all those voices, those sort of disembodied voices above the the dining table while I just, you know, looked at people's varicose veins and looked up ladies' skirts, you know.
As one does, yes.
Bored child that, you know, that, but, you know, then that was what I was capturing, and obviously I was overseas at the time, and a little bit of longing there as well. But I like.
Well,
it,
if you're longing to speak with Tim Whitten about Cloud Street, which is the most popular book for 2003 at the end of last year when we asked you to tell us about what your favourite Australian novel was, and you said Cloud Street, give us a call on 1800 802 341, 1800 802 341. I'm Ramona Koval, I'm talking with Tim Whitten and Sandy McCutcheon, and let's go to Sydney again, to Jennifer. Hi, Jennifer.
Hi, I'm currently studying Year 12 at the moment, and we've just started Cloud Street, and I was just wondering if I could ask a few quick questions.
You're doing homework.
Are you writing an essay?
No.
We're not writing your essay for you.
No, we just wrote an essay on why we thought Tim Whitten should have won the prize last year, so I've already done my essay. But I was wondering, Tim, what was the purpose of including magic realism? Like, why did you include it?
I didn't make a conscious decision about it. I just enjoyed it, and it came out of the story that I was telling. And once I'd sort of stumbled into it, I found that it belonged in the story. So there was never any conscious decision to step outside the bounds of naturalism, because I'd been writing in that sort of odd kind of hybrid way for a long time. You know, when I grew up, the books that were purely naturalistic seemed to lack something about life to me. And I think, you know, once I read, at least in Australia, once I read Patrick White, I understood, you know, that someone else felt like that too.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Jennifer in Sydney. And this, also in Sydney, is Jane. Hello, Jane.
Hi. This is actually quite interesting, because Jennifer's in my class.
Uh-oh.
She's kind of just stolen my theme of question, but that's okay. I was actually wondering if you could talk a bit about Fisher's character and the kind of involvement of his narration through the novel, and in the sense that it's from about three different perspectives.
So, Jane, sit down, get your pencil out, and I'll put you on hold so that that we can just let Tim go for it.
I better get my pencil first. It took me 2 years to realise who was telling the story of Cloud Street, so I wasn't really aware. I realised that the kind of narrator that I had was a little informal, and he or she was a little bit all over the place, and so it was a delight to finally be put out of my misery. And I think I was in Ireland or France at the time, to actually know who was telling the story. It was a great burden off my shoulders, and I felt like I knew, you know, because I mean, you know, being the writer of a book is a little bit like being the reader. You know, you're not entirely in control, and there are plenty of surprises for you. But having Fish tell the story in effect in the time that it takes him to drown, it was a pretty artificial kind of structure, I suppose, but it was what I was stuck with. Once I felt him in the water and telling this story, I sort of wasn't going to let go of it. It didn't seem like a good idea, but it seemed like my idea, and I was going to stick with it.
Well, it certainly works.
And it is interesting that Cloud Street appears on nearly every Year 12 reading list in the country. It's odd, you know, those. No, it's a great book. Come on, Tim. I know you're being modest. We all love it, though.
No, I'm not just being modest. It's hard to read, and you don't write books to be obstacles in people's path, you know, in order to get their piece of paper at the end of 12 years of school. I'm glad of the royalties, obviously, but.
But the kind of questions that obviously teachers of English will ask, like, you know, what was the writer trying to tell us here, or, you know, was this book about redemption and Christianity? I mean, all of these things are really weird for a writer to listen to, aren't they?
Yeah, and also they have a sort of assumption that you setting out to write a novel to tell people what's what, or what you think. And in a way, you know, for me, writing a novel, which is a sort of habitual act for me after all these years, it tends to be more about finding out what I think rather than what I think everyone else should hear.
Isn't it amazing, Tim, the number of things that a reader will see in a book and patterns and connections that never consciously really occur to the writer?
Yeah, and it's kind of wonderful, really. You realise that there are, you know, I mean, if there's this book Cloud Street, there are obviously a lot of Cloud Streets because they are quite separate experiences for people. You know, and there are obviously many things in common, and people have very divergent readings of it, and I like that. If a book has enough room to let people inhabit it and breathe in it and bring something to it, then I think it's been some kind of success.
You are interested in the way, you know, families and those in them cope with tragedy, an accident where a man loses his fingers or where a child is drowned and resuscitated and isn't the same as before, and the trick is to keep living. I mean, when you write, Lester thought about poor old Fish, that skylarking ratbag turned brainless overnight. There'd been times he'd thought the kid's better dead than to live all his life as a child, but he knew that being alive was being alive, and you couldn't tamper with that. You couldn't underestimate it. There's sort of a taste of living in that, isn't there? And admiration with the adaptability of people.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've had criticism over the years for, you know, my kind of melodramatic streak. There's lots of accidents in my books, and I suppose it just comes from, you know, having been the son of a policeman and having been privy to and exposed to, you know, a lot of accidents. All the violence in my life wasn't internal. It wasn't in the family. It was around us in terms of what my father was coping with in his job. And of course, you know, I had a great uncle who lost his fingers in a winch on a boat. So, you know, you just use what you know and what's in the air, and, you know, sometimes it's useful and sometimes it's not.
Well, Reg at St Andrews, I believe, hasn't read this book, and I'm not sure if we're going to be very happy about that, but he wants to make a point of nonetheless. Reg.
Yeah, first of all, nice reading, Ramona.
Thank you.
I haven't read the book. You know, I hear so much about it. It's one of those things, you know, you like a film, you hear everybody talking about it, and you think, oh, God, I'll pick that up one of these days, but you don't. But what I wanted to ask Tim, and reluctantly, because talking to writers, sometimes you feel that a lot of their ideas, not ideas so much, but a lot of things come from they know not where. I don't know whether this applies to Tim or not, but what I was conscious of during that reading, particularly during that reading, I don't know about the rest of the book, was, and although I don't know Tim's book, I know Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood very well, I couldn't help feeling that there's a strong sort of relationship between the use, in the way the words were being used. Is Tim conscious of this?
It's called good writing, I think.
Yes, indeed. But how do you feel about Dylan Thomas himself?
I've never read Under Milkwood. I've heard bits of it. Read on the radio or in the classroom, but I never actually studied it or never read it from beginning to end. But you know, it's beautiful stuff. And Thomas was almost as good a poet as he was a drinker.
Yes. Let's go to Jason in Brisbane. Hello, Jason.
Hey, hi there, Tim. I've got a question about tragedy. It seems to be an underlying theme with a lot of your books.
Sorry about that.
No, don't be sorry about it, because, I mean, my wife and I both love your stuff. And you seem to write such beautifully tragic or tragically, whatever way it goes around, beautiful stories. Tragedy, what is that a big sort of thing in your, I don't want to get too personal, but where does this underlying theme come from? Because it's in every one of your books.
It certainly doesn't come from personal experience, and perhaps it comes from the sort of the obverse, you know. I mean, I've led, you know, probably a charmed life, and it's either guilt or anxiety that some of these kind of things are going
to
be visited
upon me.
Too
good to last, yes.
But I guess it goes to, you know, having seen a lot of tough things as a child and as an insomniac. I mean, in a house where your father comes home, tells your mother things about the day that you weren't supposed to hear. But, you know, you live in a few asbestos houses in your time, and, you know, they're pretty thin walls. And also just being awake, you know. I mean, it's very hard not to. It's very hard not to see how tough and tragic life can be. I mean, unless you're, you know, completely anaesthetized by, you know, Muzak and television.
Sing the blues unless you've actually lived them. Now that's, you know, you've heard that before, but you seem to write tragedy just so beautifully. Maybe it's just a good mind, I guess.
Jason, we're going to have to leave it there because we've got a board full of calls and it's bursting. But look, thank you so much for that. Let's put him on hold and just remind you this is Cloud Street we're talking and we're talking with Tim Winton and this is Australia Talks Books. Ramona.
And now we're going to Brutham in East Gippsland to say hello to Mick. Hi, Mick.
Hi there.
Yes, Mick.
Tell us what you think.
Oh, well, I love Cloud Street, and I love the vernacular, especially words like Catholic. It's spelt really well, I think.
With a CK at the end.
Yeah, excellent. Look, I had a more general question, and that was where is Tim heading in terms of his writing? You know, I love the way he writes about landscapes, and I was wondering whether there was any plans to maybe come over to the East Coast and immerse himself in
the rest of Australia.
The East Gippsland landscape, or perhaps North Queensland would be a good one as well.
I've heard of all these places, that's probably a good question. I mean, I don't really know where I'm headed in my work at the moment. I'm just writing short stories as a kind of relief from the novel and as a kind of different kind of pleasure.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I just write, I suppose I've traditionally written about, you know, things close to home and I suppose, you know, in a way, I don't think of the books as discrete. I see them all as part of this sort of alternate world that I have the luxury of knocking together over several decades. You know, if I get a couple more. So look, who knows? Maybe there's a Noosa novel in me, but I think the odds aren't good.
1-800-802-341 is the number. We're talking with Tim Winton. Don't forget you can also go online to the discussion at abc.net.au/RN. Follow the links to Australia Talks Books, find the discussion page and leave some thoughts there. 1-800-802-341 to Meetong in Victoria. And Fiona, thanks for waiting. Fiona, welcome.
Oh, hello. How are you?
Yeah, good.
Yeah, hello to you all. That's interesting. The chap who's just, was it Nick or Mick from Brutham? He's only about probably 15 kilometres from me because we're East Gippsland people. So we're, and I...
So you're all on the phone down in East Gippsland.
We are. I would echo, I think it was Mick's, you know, like, could you please come over here and look at East Gippsland, Tim Winton, and write some...
This is an attempt by Gippsland to hijack the man.
To hijack.
Don't you understand? He doesn't have a passport for that part of Australia.
We've got a cultural desert over here, so we need people like that here. We need musicians and writers.
Mate, I make cultural deserts wherever I go. I'm proud of that.
Come over here, mate. Look, I suppose I've just rung... I haven't read Cloud Street for about 15 years, or 10 years, I suppose. And I read it in one sitting. I was Cloud Streeted out when I'd finished it. I felt it was a wonderful book. And my daughter, who was then, I suppose, 17 at the time, then took it up and read it, and she did the one sitting too. And so we were both Cloud Streeted out. And
well, I wish I could write it in one sitting.
be handy, wouldn't it, Tim?
Pretty amazing, wouldn't it? But the thing was that the weird stuff, you know, the blackfella who was always lurking about, the black man who was lurking about, and there was a particular scene that I've been made to pick up the book again and look for it, and was Quick was he was out in the water, and
this is the day he caught all the fish.
Yeah, yep. He caught all the fish, and the figure of a man walking on the water, and it made him laugh. And he said, oh, he's on a shallow bar, you know, because he's trying to get sensible. And this black man just sort of appeared, and when he got to the shore, the black fella was waiting for him in a pair of calico pants and a British battle jacket. I thought that was pretty interesting. And then the black fella sort of lurks through the, you know, like, again, through the book. And And there were these really funny sort of ghostly appearances that happened. And it was really strange because I said to my daughter, I found those bits, I believe in ghosts and things like that, but I found they were out of, like, a bit out of context or something, or I didn't feel comfortable about them, I didn't understand.
Fiona, then sit
and
down.
She, as a 17-year-old, said they were fine. They were real. They just fitted in. That was what happened.
Well, let's get a response from Tim, because we have, as I said, we've got a board full, and that was an extraordinary rave from you, Fiona. I really enjoyed it. Tim, how do you respond to that?
Oh, I don't quite know how to respond. I mean, if it doesn't work for somebody, then there's nothing I can do about it. It's a failure in the writing, or it's just a bad connection. And you know, obviously that's a bummer.
But the daughter loved it. Yes.
Okay. But let's go to Ruby in. Oh no, that was Ruby. Wasn't
no,
it?
No,
oh.
Ruby's next.
Oh, Ruby in Maryborough in Queensland. Hello, Ruby.
Hello, Ramona. Hello, Sandin.
Hello.
Tim, I've just coincidentally finished reading Cloud Street 3 weeks ago, and you're a national treasure. It's one of the most beautiful books I've ever read. I love the poetry. I had great interest and concern in all the characters, and just commenting a bit more on what a previous caller said about how you write tragedy so beautifully, I felt through reading the book that there was so much joy and love of life interwoven amongst the tragedy.
Well, thank you. I don't know what to say, really. Sandy?
Yes, all right. Well, that was a very good response. Yes. let's go to Tom.
It's so nice of you. It's like getting birthday presents.
Yeah. Look, Ruby, thank you so much for calling Tom in Toowoomba, another man who hasn't read the book. Tom?
Yeah, well...
Explain yourself.
I'm in Toowoomba at the moment. I haven't read your book, but I intend to.
Good.
But when Ramona read out that first starting of the book... Within the first 20 to 30 seconds, I visualised that she was talking about the Swan River in Perth and picnics near Como. Because when I was just after school during the late 40s, you were describing my family and picnics on the river in exactly the same way as I remember it. And that was quite a surprise. So that's why I rung you, because it just struck me so, it's just so vivid.
Oh, thanks. It's all in the reading.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Oh, that's right. It's all my fault, yes. Actually, Tim, you know, seeing Chickery Chick Chala Chala, that song, my first publicly performed act in kindergarten.
Was it?
Very good to see it.
Damaged a whole string of kids for years.
That's right. What did it mean, Chickery Chick Chala Chala?
No idea. I mean, I used to hear it a lot because my grandfather was in vaudeville, or you know, he was a vaudevillian. Into vaudeville he was, although I think he warmed up for Roy Rean once in Perth. So we, you know, all that nonsense singing and the kind of strumming of the back of fry pans and you know, jumping around in baggy pants. So there was a lot of that in the family, and my grandparents sort of had a family band as well, and my grandfather sort of managed to scrape into the second AIF because of music. He was really too old, but he got in a band, and that was his sort of second lease of life. And for a lot of people, I think, you know, once the war was over, everything went back to normal. It was a very dreary place, which you can see why they had some, you know, religious belief in the AIF.
Well, Susan's on the line from Mildura in Victoria. Hi, Susan.
Hi, how are you? How are you all?
Good.
I read Cloud Street, and I've read the writers, and I love them both. But what I want to say is I'm not an academic and not an intellectual, and I absolutely love both the books, and I absolutely adored Faulkner when I was young too, as Tim did. But he said he understood 4 out of 5 pages. I probably understood 1. But I still loved them, and I still read them at one sitting, and I still... got so much out of them, but I don't really necessarily feel that I need to understand everything. Does Tim feel that? Would he be disappointed if people didn't understand all his books?
No, not at all. I mean, when I think back to Faulkner and I think, you know, people who love Joyce, it's not really necessarily even information, that's music that, that people take away. And if somebody's carried by the music, then you know, it's sort of a feat in itself just to sweep them away. Obviously, you hope to sweep them away in a faintly coherent direction, but it's hard enough just to move people and. Yes. And it's music that does that.
Tim, can I just ask you something about the way you see the world at the moment? Because when I reread Cloud Street, that wonderful innocence of the lambs and the pickles seems almost from another age, to me anyway. When you look around Australia now, what are you seeing? What kind of place?
I'm not sure how innocent the place was. And there's a certain viciousness to innocence at times. I mean, even the scene in Cloud Street where there's sort of complete ignorance about the fact that the Aborigines didn't have the vote, and they're all sitting around talking about, you know, which way you voted, and the complete, almost callous shock that people had. There's a certain nastiness to innocence. So I mean, I just don't want to be too nostalgic. I don't know if Australia is that much less innocent. I think perhaps there's a lot of willful ignorance, but that's not quite the same. I don't know. I think we, you know, in a way, we joined the world and then had second thoughts. And I still think Australia is a, you know, deeply conformist culture. And you look at the politics at the moment, and you've got an opposition leader desperately trying to say something that sounds different but really isn't different. Because if you said something that was different, then you'd be running the risk of frightening the horses.
Frightening the sheep. Tim, we need to wrap it up. I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and spending the time with us. Again, it's been wonderful, and we look forward to your writing of short stories. I'm sure, Ramona, that you look forward to that just as much as I do.
I do, absolutely. Hurry up. Get them out.
Books and writing. What's coming up, Ramona?
Well, this week we enter the mind of musical genius in the 19th century world of Clara Schumann, who was married to Robert, composer, performer, but he was very, very a difficult man to live with. He had a big mental illness, and she had 8 kids. And, you know, it's a very wonderful novel by Janice Galloway. So Janice Galloway, Scottish writer, will be joining me because I spoke to her at the recent Perth Festival of Words and Ideas. And she's great. You know, she is really fiery and full of fun.
Do you listen to...
We like that.
Do you listen to classical music, Tim?
I don't care for it to be called classical music, and I think I've seen it as I'm a little like some, you know, if you call it classical, then it's, you know, it's dangerous. It's sort of pushing it away from the listener. But yes, I like classical music.
Yes. Coming up on Australia Talks Books, a very different book next time, Ramona.
Yes, in March we'll be talking about Sue Wolfe's book, The Secret Cure. And it's about autism, it's also about science, the story of Eva, the cleaning lady in a small Australian scientific laboratory. She was a junior technician who worked there years ago, and nobody knows she's on a secret mission to discover a cure for autism for her autistic child. And it's about also a reclusive man who spies on her but loves her deeply. And it's a very moving novel, so you've all got to read it. And then Sue Wolfe will join us at the end of March, last Friday in March, to talk about it and take your calls.
That's The Secret Cure. And let me just remind you, Books and Writing with Ramona is on at 1:05 on Sunday afternoon and repeated on Tuesday afternoon at 2:30. Have I got the times right, Ramona?
Perfecto.
Ah, good. And what a treat having Tim on the program today. It's been so good. And Ramona, having you back, thank you so much for coming back and working with us again. I look forward to talking with you and Sue Wolfe next month.
Me too.
That's Ramona Cavall, and don't forget those times for Books and Writing. And coming up to tonight on Radio National, Jackie Ozarski, the icon of Australian music, and the Whitlams, all sorts of other bands, live on stage tonight at 7 o'clock. And coming up on Australia Talks Back, well, on Monday, after you've had a very relaxing weekend, you can think about retirement, because full-time retirement may be a thing of the past. That's the slogan behind the government's efforts to solve our ageing problem. But what on earth does the Treasurer mean when he says demography is our destiny? And what impact will this have on our family, our work, and our health? all of that and more. And I hope that you'll have a chance to have a relaxing weekend and then join us for that on Monday. So, to Ramona, Tim Winton and the gang, thanks indeed for a great week. See you next time.